Passes around. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies Live. This is our weekly look at the soul of the Torah portion. This week's Torah portion is one of my favorites. It's one of my top 53. Joking, there are only 53 Torah portions. So it is the Torah portion of Mishpatim, and it is significant to me personally because, let me think how many years ago. Wow, I'm going to be dating myself. 27 years ago, this Shabbat was my bar mitzvah.
Oh, wow.
Oh. Yes. 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 So yesterday was my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you for the good wishes. And yeah. So this is a Torah portion that's near and dear to me. We have a really great discussion that I think is going to, at the same time, raise a ton of eyebrows and also be compelling and possibly life catapulting in a good way. Not like, but like in a positive growth directional fashion. So let's open up the Chumash to Mishpatim. David, you look like you're ready with the place. What page are we on?
478.
He even says it like I says it. 478, 479, Mishpatim. Now, before we begin, let's get the context. So last week, we read about the giving of the Torah at Sinai, the Ten Commandments, divine revelation, all that good stuff. This is the Torah portion that comes right after. Like, okay, revelation at Sinai, what comes next? I'm glad you asked. The Torah portion of Mishpatim. One more introduction. There are three types of mitzvot. There are 613 commandments, mitzvot, Jewish commandments in the Torah. Those can be broken down into three general categories. Mishpatim, Eidos, and Chukim. What are these three categories? So let's start with the Mishpatim. Mishpatim are civil laws that make sense. Eidos are testimonial laws that only make sense once you have them. And Chukim are laws that even after we've studied it for years, we have no idea why they exist. And I'll give you examples. The commandment to honor one's parents. The commandment to give charity. The commandment to against, the prohibition against killing or stealing. All of these are mishpatim. All of these are mishpatim. And mishpatim means basically they are civil laws that are understandable. In fact, in the language of the Talmud says that even if, God forbid, Torah had not been given, human beings could have possibly arrived at the moral codes of the Mishpatim laws on their own. Let's get to the next category. Eidos are testimonial mitzvot, and those are mitzvot that we wouldn't have come to on our own. But once we have them, they make sense. Testimonials are typically the holidays or other ceremonial commemorative mitzvot. So God says, hey, literally, hey, joking. But God says, hey, I took you out of Egypt. So every year on Passover, celebrate. Sit down with a meal, a Paschal lamb, some matzah, some bitter herbs. Bitter herb, I don't mean like Uncle Herb, who's always upset about not finding that parking spot. But anyway, getting back to this discussion. So God says, celebrate Passover with a Seder. That's a mitzvah, that's a ceremony that we might have not come up with on our own exactly like that, but once we have it, it makes sense. In fact, every nation, every people, every society has a category of laws or occasions that are similar. In America, we have Thanksgiving, 4th of July, we have our own testimonial days, days that bear testimony to some event or some sort of thing that happened. Shabbat would be included in this in mitzvot, and other mitzvot that kind of harken back to something or bespeak some other event or some other significant concept. The third category of chukim are those mitzvot that we have no idea why they exist. We don't even, like the laws of kosher. Laws of kosher, we might attribute some reasons to it, but ultimately, this divine diet is beyond our understanding. Ritual purity and impurity. You touch this thing, oh, you become impure. How do you become pure again? Well, this is complicated. You got to wait a few days, dip in a mikvah. Wait, why? This is the way it is. You come in contact with human death. Oh, now you need a paraduma, a red heifer. What's the red heifer? It's complicated, right? So why? How does it work? All of these things. These are categories. Welcome back. Good to see you. These are categories of mitzvot. Can we squeeze you guys in somewhere? Let's see. You want to? Okay. You know what we got two. No, you're good. Steve will move here. Anyway, Steve, I need someone good to answer some questions that are going to be directed toward me. So you're going to get all the hot questions. You guys are good right here. We got two together. I'm like an usher at the Super Bowl. Two together? Two tickets? Yay, right. I priced it out. When I saw it, like the cheapest were like $36.50. I'm like, that's a lot of shekel. Okay, but getting back. So these are chukim. Chukim, we don't understand. They don't really, to us, they don't make a lot of sense. We do it. It exercises our surrender and our obedience. Could we do things that we might not understand because God is telling us to do it? And that's the value of those mitzvot. Our Torah portion is called Mishpatim. Mishpatim talks about primarily those mitzvot that make sense, civil law. You damage someone, you got to pay for the damages. Respect your elders, lend money to the poor. All of these are commandments, mitzvot, found in this week's Torah portion called Mishpatim Category 1. Make sense so far? Great. Here's the problem. The first mitzvah that we encounter in the Torah portion of Mishpatim is a mitzvah that is a little bit tricky. It's a little bit tricky. So let's read this inside. We're going to have a lot of questions on this opening statement of Mishpatim. Steve, please get us started. 479, chapter 21 of Exodus, Parshas Mishpatim.
And these are the laws that you should set before them. If you buy a Hebrew slave who is sold to slavery by the court because he was a thief, he shall work 6 years. But in the seventh year, he is to be released without liability. If he was unmarried when he entered service, he may not marry a non-Jewish slave woman during his period of service. He shall be released unmarried. If he is married to a Jewish woman when he enters service, the master must provide food for the wife and children until he is released with his wife. If his master gives him a non-Jewish slave woman for a wife, and she bears him sons or daughters, then when it is time to dismiss the Hebrew slave, the woman and her children will remain with her remain her master's property, and he is dismissed alone. If the slave says, "I love my master, my non-Jewish wife, and my children, I will not go free," his master shall bring him to the judges of the Jewish court who sold him the slave in the first place. Standing the slave next to the door, which is attached to a doorpost, his master shall pierce his right ear with a pointed tool. He must then serve his master forever until the Jubilee year.
Okay, and that's it. That's all we need. Folks, I preface this by saying Mishpatim are laws we understand, we get. However, the first law gets a little bit dicey. And you see what I mean? You guys were following along with this the whole slave discussion? Which part of it? I got a half a dozen questions at least. What do you have?
How can to pierce his ear, you know?
Well, people do that all the time, if you think about it, huh? Right? No, the piercing the ear. We're actually gonna ask a question about the ear situation. But at its core, piercing the ear is, yeah. You know. I don't know which part of the ear they pierce. That is not something you're saying. Yeah, that's not something that. Would you come up with that on your own?
No.
That's going to be one of my questions. Hold on. Good. Good. I like how you're thinking. That's one of my questions. What else?
If he was unmarried,
yeah,
he can't marry a non-Jewish slave woman.
Correct.
How would his master give him a non-Jewish slave
woman? If he's married to a Jewish woman and he becomes a slave, then his master can give him a non-Jewish maidservant as a second wife.
Oh.
But then when he goes free,
he
has to leave her behind unless he says, "Ahavti es, what does he say? Says, Ahavti es Adoni, I love my master. As Ishti, my new wife, the second wife. As Banai, my new children. Lo etzei chavshi, I don't want to go. Then we do the process, then he has to stay until the Jubilee year, which is 50 years. It's not a subjective count, it's an objective count of 50 years. So it could be in a few years, it could be in a few decades, whatever. But that's the extent of the duration. Look, there's a lot of questions here, right? A lot of interesting things. First of all, what's a slave? Since when does Judaism have slaves? What's up with slavery? Doesn't sound like a good thing. Okay. I want to focus on Jillian's question. What's the deal with the piercing of the ear? It sounds a little bit, I don't know, a little bit cruel,
yeah.
Barbaric maybe. Why are we piercing this fellow's ear? He says he wants to stay. He likes his wife. He likes his kids. So, all right, no problem, but we're going to have to pierce your ear. Why? What's going on? That's going to be a core question that we're going to address tonight. But before we get there, we need to take a half a step back and talk about slavery and Jewish law in general. Now, we need to preface this by explaining that this was not a normative situation. In other words, Jewish slaves was not the norm. This is only something that could happen in two cases that would be exceptions to the rule of how the Jewish society was run back in biblical times. Okay. What were the two scenarios in which a person could become a slave? Scenario number one, is if the person stole something and does not have the means to repay it. Now, if maybe you're wondering, well, if somebody stole something, then why don't they have the means to repay it? Just give it back. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that because, as you may know, when people steal things, they sometimes sell it. And when you sell it, sometimes you use the cash to buy other things. And you might have, the thief might have, you know, blown through the cash. And now there's nothing left. There's no more money. So the thief is caught. And now the thief has to pay restitution. In fact, in Jewish law, some of you may know this, if a thief is caught, the thief has to pay back the principal amount plus what?
Interest.
Plus double. Like one more time. So if they stole $100 worth of stuff, they have to actually return the 100 plus tack on another 100. That's considered to be, it's called kefel, which means double. And it's considered to be a knas, which is a, how do you translate knas? Like a punishment. It's a fine. Oh, it's a fee. Yeah, that's good. It's a fine. You're fine. You have to pay back the principals. Obviously, you have to pay restitution what you stole. Plus, there's a fine tacked on top of it. If you steal certain other items, if you steal an animal and slaughter the animal, then there's a greater fine. Depending on the animal, it could be 4 or 5 times the value of the original animal is your knas, is your fine. But be that as it may, a person who stole and does not have the funds to pay restitution, not of the fine, but of the original, they had a recourse to become a slave. In fact, the courts could sell them as a slave if they didn't have any money. So a person shows up in court, the thief has his day in court, and the court says, okay, this is what you have to pay. And the thief says, I don't have the money. So what happens? The thief walks? No. We say, are you sure you don't have the money? No, check all the bank accounts. Okay.
That's discrimination between poor thieves and rich.
Yes. Yes, it is. It is what it is. I don't write the rules. That's a good question. You know that by now. I don't write these rules. You're right, it is discrimination. Right? The fellow that has the means can pay it and walk. The fellow doesn't. But think about the old like cliche in the restaurant. You know, you go to the restaurant, you order, you don't have the money. The next scene in the movie is what? Some dude washing the dishes, right? That's it. You gotta pay for it somehow. So that's what the courts would do sometimes. That was at least one valid option of being a slave. The other valid option of being a slave would be in a scenario where a person was destitute and they could not take care of their family. They couldn't feed themselves, their wife, their kids. And extremely impoverished, so that person sometimes was allowed, permitted by the courts, to sell themselves into slavery in order to earn some money. Now, Here's how it works. It's not really that they would earn money, but a slave, but a slave master in Jewish law, which I don't like that name, but the, I guess it's the language, master, the master of the slave in Jewish law has to support the slave and the family. So if a person can't support their family, they could go into this mode of slavery, then they're taken care of, and their family is taken care of as well. You with me so far? It's a solution, perhaps, for the destitute, yeah. Now, so these were the only valid two options. Now, why are these the only valid two options? Because we have a general notion that we ought not be slaves to other human beings. Take a look at text 2a. Suzanne, right? Would you like to read? Open up the booklets to page 65. This is a quote from earlier on in Exodus, just one chapter prior, Exodus 20. Please read text 2a.
I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall not have the gods of others in my presence.
Now turn the page, please, to 66, and please, Suzanne, please read text 2b.
Who took you out of the land of Egypt? Taking you out of Egypt. It's sufficient reason for you to be subservient to me.
Rashi says, why does God mention, oh, you know who I am? I'm the one who took you out of Egypt. By saying that, God is saying, hey, remember what I did for you? The least you can do is all these mitzvot forever. I mean, for many thousands of years, right? I took you out of Egypt. I saved your skin. I took you out of the house of bondage, out of slavery. So, kedai hi ha'itzah shetiyu meshubadim li. It's enough reason for you to now be subservient to me and follow my desires, my wishes, my commands. Fantastic. What do we see here? We see essentially God is saying, I took you out of human servitude so that
you can serve me.
Which means that ultimately, who should we be serving? God. Should we be serving other human beings? No. So now what we see here is a general take on the notion of slavery. A human being should not essentially ever really be a slave to another human being. One human being should not be a slave to another. I don't know if you know this. Jewish labor law. Let me take a half a step back again. Jewish law halacha covers every aspect of life. So sometimes we think that Jewish law covers like ritual stuff or religious stuff. Like if I want to have a divine experience, okay, maybe Judaism has something to say about it, but if I want to know how to run a business, how to treat my employees, that we have local laws and other regulations and U.S. whatever. I'm here to tell you that every area of life is spoken about in the context of Jewish law and practice and ethics and values, including labor law. And one of the interesting things about Jewish labor law is that you cannot force a worker to work even when they've signed a contract. If you've hired a worker, you have a very important project. You need to build this building or whatever it is. You need to build something, create something. You hire a worker and they sign a contract and say, yes, I will work. And then halfway through, or not even halfway through, 5 minutes in, they say, you know what? Not doing it. You cannot force them to work. You cannot force them to actually work.
Can you fire them?
For sure. Yeah. You can fire, but you can't force another human being to work. Why? Because if you could force someone to work,
slavery.
It would be slavery. It would be forced slavery. And the only options in halacha and Jewish law are when a person has stolen something and can't repay it, and then they're on the hook for restitution, or someone who's so impoverished that to them this is their only hope, and it's their choice. But otherwise, that another human being should have the power to enslave someone else, it's a mufrach lagamri. It's completely, I say mufrach, it's mufrach.
Unacceptable.
It's unacceptable. It's totally off, it's off the table. That one human being should force work, slavery, servitude on someone else, chas v'sham, God forbid. The only time that applies, even possibly, And who knows how widespread this was? Probably not, because it's very, very isolated scenarios. The only possibilities were stealing and a person who was absolutely destitute, and this was their only option. They felt this was their only option. Let's take a look at this as written beautifully by, oh, I want to say beautifully, clearly by Maimonides' text 3a. Ray, please read this, 66.
The term Hebrew servant used in the Torah refers to a Jew whom the court sells by compulsion, or a person who sells himself willingly. What is implied? When a person steals and does not have the resources to repay the principal, the court sells him, as we have explained in the laws concerning thievery. To what does the term a person who sells himself refer? When a Jew becomes sorely impoverished, the Torah gives him permission to sell himself as a servant, as in Vayikra, when your brother will become impoverished and be sold to you. A person is not allowed to sell himself as a servant and stash away the money, use it to buy merchandise or utensils, or give it to his creditor. He may sell himself only when he needs the money for his very livelihood. A person is not permitted to sell himself unless he has no property remaining at all. Even his clothing no longer remains. Only in such a situation may he sell himself.
You see what's going on here? So you have the first scenario, which is when a person steals and doesn't have the money. So we say, we're not letting you off the hook. You have to work until you pay it back. And then once you pay it back, then you're out. And then you have extreme poverty. As Maimonides says, as Rambam says, a person who doesn't even have clothing. That's extreme. It's not like I need some extra cash. Let me work for somebody on this level. No, this is only in rare situations. Otherwise, it's not sanctioned by Jewish law. It's not a valid arrangement. It's not a valid agreement. And again, let alone, it's not even on the table to discuss where somebody else should impose that upon someone else. Are you with me so far? Fine. So I just want to paint the picture here. Now. We said before that there are two scenarios the Torah, well, we read it in the Torah, in the Chumash itself, in the text, where it talks about two scenarios of the Jewish slave, two marital status scenarios, right? One scenario is the, obviously, right? One scenario is the fellow is, come on guys, help me out here, is not married, right? The second one is where he is married, right? So either he's single or he's married. If he's single, we said, what does the Torah say? If he was unmarried when he entered service, he may not marry a non-Jewish slave woman during his period of service. In other words, he remains single throughout the duration. He comes in single, he goes out single. In begapo yavo, begapo yetze. If he comes in single, he goes out. In other words, his entire duration and his exit is also with him being in a status of single bachelorhood. If he comes in to the slavery arrangement, if he comes in married, then he is allowed to marry, in addition, biblically a man can have more than one wife, but that's another conversation. He is allowed to marry, or his master is allowed to marry him off to a non-Jewish slave woman and bear children. And that's the second scenario. Take a look where this is clarified, again, in Maimonides' text 3b. Ray, please read this one as well, top of 68.
A Hebrew servant is not permitted to marry a Canaanite maidservant unless he already has a Jewish wife and children. If, however, he does not have a Jewish wife and children, his master may not give him a Canaanite maidservant. This concept is part of the oral tradition.
Yes, and it was in the parentheses in our Chumash, in our English text. It was in the parentheses, and that was taken from classic understanding of the biblical text. Yes? Correct? You don't see it?
No, I'm just confused between verse 3 and the beginning of verse 4.
So again, verse 3, if we go back to the Chumash, page 479, verse 3 says, if he was unmarried when he entered service, he may not marry a non-Jewish slave woman during his period of service. He shall be released unmarried. He remains single throughout.
But later it says, if the master gives him a non-Jewish slave
No, but that's following the heels of the next line. If he is married to a Jewish woman, if he is married when he enters service, the master must provide food for the wife and children. As I said before, that would be the motivation of someone who's destitute. And if his master gives him a non-Jewish slave woman for a wife, in that latter context where he was already married, etc., etc., etc. Now, let's break this down. This is going to be, it's not that complicated, but it's just a few steps to this logical understanding and understanding the scenario. Remember, the situation where we pierce the fellow's ear, why did we pierce his ear? What did he want? Why did the Torah say, why does he want to remain a slave? The Torah says, if he will say, I want to remain a slave, why? What's the stated rationale or argument? Why does he want to remain a slave? Because he loves his
master.
That's not what it says. His wife and his children. No, it does say master, but it doesn't only say master. Ahavti es Adoni, es Ishti, ve'es Banai. I love my master and my wife. Which wife?
The second wife.
The non-Jewish maidservant. That's why he wants to stay. He has a wife and kids back home or whatever, right? That are getting supported also. But he says, I don't want to leave this new arrangement because I love my master. I love my new wife, the second wife. And I love my second kids. Okay. That is when he can extend the duration. Correct? That's when the Torah states the scenario of extending the time period past the 6 years, getting the whole board in the ear. Yes? You with me? Okay. It's therefore not illogical to assume that the situation where the fellow is getting a hole in his ear for wishing to stay is a situation where he was married and had kids, right? Because that's the scenario we're talking about. And why is he a slave? Do you think it's because he stole or because he couldn't support them? It's very likely that it's scenario B, where he couldn't support them. And so now I have an even stronger question. Jillian's question is even stronger. And the question is, Nebuch, here you have a fellow who can't support his wife, can't support his kids. The only way they're being supported, huh?
So now he's got more.
He has more. But they're all being supported by the master, right? So now he says, look, I don't have money. I still don't have money. The slave, it's not like he puts away, it's not like he's stashing his 401k, right? That's not, right? He's not like building equity here with his arrangement, right? He's still under the, what's it called again? He's being supported by the master. So here you have a fellow who's being supported by the master, and he says, look, I like this arrangement. I want to stay. Let me stay. And we say, you know what? No, you shouldn't stay. And because you want to stay, forget about it. We're gonna impale your ear with some sort of, what does it say? With an awl?
This is a pointed
tool. A pointed rusty tool. Oh, kidding, not a rusty tool. A pointed, sanitized, what's it? What's the language? Sterilized tool. Through the ear. I don't know where in the ear went in. Hopefully, in somewhere that wasn't so painful. But the point is, we put a hole in the ear. Why? Because he wanted to stay. But why did he want to stay? Because maybe he couldn't support his family still. So you're taking a guy who's in a vulnerable situation, and you're making things worse for him. Why do you hurt him? Why do you make him suffer? What's going on? Okay. So the question has just become amplified. Let's strengthen the question. You see, if Judaism, is the question clear? Why are we doing this to the slave? Okay, let's have some compassion here. Now, a person might think, without looking at Jewish law, a person might say, well, you know what? This indicates clearly the Jewish perspective on slaves. The Jewish perspective on slaves is, you can abuse them. You can beat them up. You can pierce their ears. You know, in a doorpost or next to a doorpost. Clearly, though, that assumption or that conclusion is not founded upon Jewish law. When you look at Jewish law, an altogether different picture emerges about the level of compassion and care that one has to have to a Jewish slave. Let's take a look at text number 4. David, please read this one, page 68 at the bottom.
And it will be, if he says so to you, I will not leave you, because he loves you and your household it is good for him with you.
Let me explain. This is from Devarim, from Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Torah, where it's called Mishneh Torah. It repeats a lot of the mitzvot that we've had in the previous four books are repeated in the fifth book. So here it repeats this law that we have in Exodus. It talks about, again, a slave that wants to stay on, but there it adds some more words. Why does he want to stay on? He says, I love you, to the master, and your household, for it is good, because he loves you and your household, for it is good for him with you. He likes being there. So on this, the Talmud comments 4b. One more text, please. 4b. Why does the slave enjoy being there? Take a look.
The sages taught, for it is good for him with you. The slave is truly with you. You're equal in food, you're equal in drink. You may not eat fine bread while he eats inferior bread. You may not drink aged wine while he drinks new wine. You may not sleep on soft sheets while he sleeps on straw. From here the sages taught, anyone who acquires a Hebrew slave, it is as if he acquired a master for himself, since he is responsible for giving the slave everything equal to his own.
Are you with me on this? Look at that. Someone who has a Hebrew slave, it's not like you can tell them demeaning things. It's not like you can do whatever you want. It's like you can treat them as an inferior. If you're whatever you're eating, they need to eat. There's no separate menu. There's no separate inferior lodging or living quarters or sleeping arrangements. No, it's the same thing. And so therefore, our sages teach, if you acquire a slave, you've actually acquired a master for yourself. You're going to be running after. So like, yeah, you may get some help around the house or whatever it is, but otherwise, it's a big responsibility. So a person might have thought, well, based on the whole ear puncture thing, well, that shows where Judaism stands on slaves and how we can treat them. But when you look at halakha, you look at Jewish law, it's clear that Jewish law says, on the contrary, you have to treat a slave, a Jewish slave, the white glove treatment. Take the absolute best care, which then makes this whole commandment all the more puzzling. So why, when this poor fellow who maybe, not the thief, the guy who has no money, absolutely destitute, this is the only way he can support his family. He wants to stay on a little bit longer. He's now fallen in love with the new wife. He likes his kids. He loves his kids. So you punish him. You hurt him. What's going on? What kind of mitzvah is this? What kind of response is that? So now, the classic explanation is given by Rashi. Rashi on our verse in Exodus, Rashi gives the classic explanation of why the hole in the ear. Let's read this text number 5. Dan, please read this one, page 70.
Why was the ear chosen to be bored out of all the organs of the body? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, the ear that heard on Mount Sinai, you shall not steal, and then went and stole, shall be pierced. And if the text is referring to one who sold himself into servitude, the reason is that the ear that heard, for the children of Israel are slaves to me, and then went and acquired a master for himself, this ear shall be pierced.
So Rashi cites, it's either the Talmud or the Midrash, Rashi cites a classic teaching of our sages, namely Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who says that the ear is pierced because the ear should have known better. Or the ear obviously didn't do a good job listening in the first place. If the fellow is in slavery because of stealing, then the ear clearly didn't listen to when God said, don't steal. And if the person is in slavery because they were impoverished and therefore had to sell themselves into slavery, nonetheless, the person should have listened to when God says, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim avadayhem. What God says, to me, the Jewish people are servants or slaves, which implies to God and not to other human beings, not to fellow human beings. And now we have a rationale for both, according to Rashi. If the fellow stole, the ear should have known better. Not stealing. If the fellow sold himself into slavery, again, the ear should have known better. The ear should have known not to enslave oneself to another human being. Make sense? To me, the questions are still there. In fact, I have about 6 or 7 questions. After all is said and done, we have about 6 or 7 questions. I don't know if I'll remember them all, but I'm ready to start. Ready, number one. Number one, yeah, maybe the ear should have heard better. Maybe the person is not following exactly what God wanted. Yeah, the person violated, do not steal. The person violated, you know, you're my slaves, which implies not to be a slave to someone else. Fine. So since when does Torah puncture people's ears for not listening? Right? Somebody doesn't honor their parents properly. Come here. You're getting the old ear puncture. Right? I got my hole punch. That's so terrible. Right? Since when? Right? Oh, the person didn't listen. God said, don't steal. So you're telling me by every thief that steals, you puncture their ear? Oh, no? So why here? And everyone that violates any commandment in the Torah, you puncture their ear, should have listened better? Never. What is this? Rashi says, oh, should have listened better. So since when is puncturing the ear because of not listening? For the average person, present company excluded, there might not be a lot of ear left after a few rounds, after a few days of living. Ah, got you on that one, got you on that one, got you on the other. It's like Gewalt. You ever see those boxers after a while with the, yeah, all right, whatever. Anyway.
That's why it's a lot of piercing now.
That's self-inflicted, that's self-created.
But it doesn't hurt.
Listen, what about some of that? See, here's the thing. I'm not saying that the Torah doesn't say that it has to hurt. And the implication here is not that it should inflict pain, but it should be a sign on the body that the ear didn't hear. But I'm asking, even if there's no pain, since when are we marking the body for not marking the ear for not listening? Why are we cherry picking? It's like, oh, this slave didn't listen. Either stole or sold himself to slavery. Oh, let's puncture the ear. Since when is that a thing? Why are we doing that? Number one. Number two, can we have some compassion on the fellow who's destitute? You want to tell me about the thief? Should have known better? Fine. But what about the destitute fellow? He's destitute. Fine, God says, you're my servants. The fellow's like, I don't have any clothing. My kids don't have any food. All right, there's an option. I'm taking the option. So why are we, you know, the famous statement, why are we piercing a guy's ear while he's down? Okay, that's not a statement, but that's my statement now. Right, it's famous now. It's now famous with broadcast live. So what's up with that? Like the fellow is poor and destitute and therefore not doing everything maybe exactly like we would ideally want it to be. It's not an ideal situation. Desperate times call for desperate measures. And now, so we're piercing his ear? Come on. What is that? Even if it doesn't hurt, what is this? The ear shaming. What is that? More questions. This is the Torah portion of Mishpatim, right? Mishpatim are logical laws. Okay, well, we for sure picked the doozy to start with. Here's the logical laws. Let's talk about slaves and ears and doorposts. It's like, what? Is this logical? Does this make sense? We have a lot of questions so far. It doesn't seem so logical. It's not necessarily how we would have come up with it if we were left to our own devices. So how does it fit into Mishpatim? Certainly we wouldn't have chosen this notion of the ear boring. And so why is it Mishpatim? Why is it the first mitzvah in the Torah portion, Mishpatim, is the mitzvah regarding the slave? And why is this the first message after the portion that talks about Sinai? It's almost like, now that you have the Torah, here's what you need to know. Here's what you need to know. Let's talk about slaves. It's like, really? Is it the first thing? Is that like this like obscure scenario where somebody stole and can't repay? Someone's so destitute they have no other recourse. That's going to be our first, like the first thing, first topic of discussion. It's like you're teaching a child to drive, a teenager to drive. So you're like, all right, here's what you need to know. Right? You got your permit. Before you get into the car, here's what you need to know. In a rare situation, I mean, like you see what I'm saying? You're going to go kind of mainstream. Let's talk about the popular things, right? Later on the Torah portion, not too far off, we have things that are much more common. By raise of hands, has anybody been involved in any sort of car crash, accident, dent, bump, anything regarding a car in the last 12 months? Oh, sorry, in the last... in the last 5 years. Yeah, okay, never?
Ever, I was saying.
Oh, ever. And if we did ever, everyone's hand would go up, right? So Torah talks about, well, what happens if your car, sorry, if your cow gores another cow, little cow-on-cow violence. Or what happens if your cow eats, you know, the produce, the flower, the fields of someone else's, that belongs to someone else. Torah speaks about it in Mishpatim. It's practical laws that are relevant. You know, what happens when you get into a car accident? So you call, you know, what's the process? Who pays, who's liable? What's the payout? There were no cars then, but it talks about these types of laws. But the opening law should talk about slaves? And this obscure situation where a fellow wants to stay longer and so we're poking a hole in his ear. What's going on? Yeah.
That might be. Because their past experience was as slaves.
Good. Nice. Yeah. So you're saying it might be slavery on the mind type thing. I like that. You know what? I like that. That's not the direction we're going to go in our class. But I want to say that if that was the message, I would have presented the laws a little bit differently. You know what I would have said? I would have said like this. I would have said it clearly in the Torah. I would have said, look, if somebody in general, don't have slaves. You just got out of slavery. You know what it feels like. Don't do that to someone else. That would be message number one. Message number two is, in rare circumstances, this may need to happen. But if it does, here's how you have to treat them. Because remember, you were slaves. That's what I would say. Not this obscure scenario, or not start off with like a given, yeah, if there's a Jewish slave, like, well, how do we get here? What are the laws of how we treat them? No, let's cut that out. Let's talk about slaves, and then staying, and then boring a hole in the air. I get what you're saying about the continuity there, and about like the frame of reference, but I would have, if that's the angle, I feel like it could have been a stronger message, you know, like an anti-slavery message, or kind of remember, be compassionate, you know, as you go by. Look, it seems harsh. Maybe cruel is too strong of a term, but it seems like a harsh thing. Here's a fellow who clearly was struggling, you know, and now we do this. A person might posit that, look, maybe Judaism is, maybe the laws of Judaism are a little bit harsh. Maybe for a thief, certainly, and even for someone else who's having a difficult time. Maybe the law is harsh. You want to stay longer? Here's the law. The law is 6 years. That's it. That's the term. You want to stay longer? You're violating the law? It's going to cost you a hole in the ear. That's it. So the law is the law, and it's rigid, and therefore it's a little bit harsh. But we know that Jewish law is not only compassionate, we said, to the slave in general, Jewish law is always compassionate to whoever stands before the courts. Jewish law in general takes a compassionate approach to justice. This is something we're going to find in our upcoming criminal justice reform course, Crime and Consequence, which is starting in a few weeks. Judaism is very compassionate when it comes to the law. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice you shall pursue. But justice needs to be pursued in a tzedek way, in a righteous way. Tzedek in Hebrew means not only justice, it means, tzedek means like tzaddik, right. Righteousness. So it's translated as justice, justice you shall pursue, but you could easily translate it as righteousness, righteousness you shall pursue, which means that the mishpat, the justice, has to be done in a tzedek fashion, in a righteous, compassionate way. And we find this in scripture, in the Talmud, and in practical application as well. Let's jump now to text number 6, page 71. And please read this.
They will not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy his appetite, for he is hungry.
Look at that. If a person steals because he's hungry, don't come down on him too hard. Don't despise him. Understand where he's coming from. Now, it doesn't mean that you can get away with it, but it means that you understand the context. Okay? Text number... You know what? If you don't mind... read text 7 as well, because that was very, very short.
Three things things cause a person to act against his will and the will of his creator, and one of them is extreme poverty. What are the practical ramifications of this idea? It allows us to request mercy for those people acting against their will.
The Talmud explains. The Talmud says that that extreme poverty can cause someone to act against his true will and against it. In other words, inside, the person doesn't want to steal. The person's not a thief. But a person may end up stealing because of extreme poverty. And so the Talmud says, so why are you telling me this? Talmud almost asks itself, so what's the implication? What do I do with that information? Talmud says, you know what you do with the information? To request mercy for those people acting against their will. If somebody steals out of desperation, act with them. So the justice has to happen, but act in a way of mercy as well. Understanding. Famous story. You may have heard the story with Mayor LaGuardia. You know the story with Mayor LaGuardia? Do you know that there was a Mayor LaGuardia of New York City?
Yeah.
He was also a judge. And he was Jewish. With the name LaGuardia, he was Jewish.
Huh? I didn't know he was Jewish.
Yeah, his mother was Jewish. Yeah, legit. His father was Italian, mother was Jewish. So LaGuardia, right? Flown into the airport. Man, it's a mess right now. Have you been there lately? The construction? Oh my gosh. I keep on flying into LaGuardia. I'm like, they're not done yet.
It was no good before.
Anyway, Leia just flew back and forth to JFK. She's like, that's the way to go. Okay, let's get back to this point. So LaGuardia. So May LaGuardia was one. So it was December, I think it was December 25th or maybe December 24th at night. And everyone's eating Chinese food, right? Joking. And at least all the Jews. And New York City, it's cold, and they needed a judge to sit in on the evening court, the night court. So he shows up, and they needed a judge, and he's a judge. So he went to preside over some cases, and he hears a case of a woman, I think she was a grandmother, who stole some bread from a bakery. And then it was, I want to say the 1930s, maybe. That could be the wrong decade, but I think it was the 30s. You can fact check me if you'd like, just Google the story. And at that point in New York City, there was a very tough laws against stealing bread in particular, because it was a thing that was rampant, and they came down very strongly with fines and other things. So she gets up there, and she, you know, he asked, did you do it? She said, yeah, I did it. Why did you steal? She says, my grandchildren don't have any food to eat. I needed food for my grandkids. They're starving. They're hungry. They haven't eaten in a while. So he's listening. He says, okay, the law is that the law is to fine you a certain amount, you know, the value of that plus whatever it is. I think the total was like $35, which was a lot of money in those days, in the 19, whatever it was. And he says, so I rule against you, this is what you owe. And then he said, and I further rule that I'm going to fine every single person in this courtroom a certain amount, like maybe a dollar, for living in a city that allows for children to go hungry. And he fined everyone in the courtroom, and he ordered them to pay it to her, to pay the fine. See what he did? That is an example of compassionate justice. She has to pay the fine, but he said, how can you let a neighbors of yours go hungry? How is that okay? How is that moral? So he had everyone else pitch in to help pay it. That's an example of the Jewish version on justice. How do we reconcile that with, here's a fellow, if he stole, maybe he was desperate. If he's trying to support his family, well, then he's trying to support his family, and he's destitute. How do we reconcile this compassionate take on justice with boring the hole in his ear? You see, I told you we were going to ask this question, and I've asked it probably about a dozen times, but we come back to the same question. It really boggles the mind. What is the deal with the ear? Okay. We're skipping text 8. And text 9 makes the point. We're not going to read it inside. Text 9 makes the point that a person becomes attached to their wife and children. Certainly this slave became attached. we might assume, to his new wife, second wife, and his new children. Therefore, it's understandable that he says, I don't want to leave them forever. I don't want to say goodbye and never see them again. So if he wants to stay on again, why puncture the ear? And now we need to get into the a response or answer. Why? Why not what? Why not? Why not release the wife? Let them all go happily ever after. I don't know.
What is the master going to do with the wife?
Wait for the next one to come around. I don't know. I guess we can add that. I don't have a good answer for that, though. I have an answer for the other stuff. I don't have an answer for that. You're on your own now. You're treading in your own. I don't know. It's a good question. Let's see one approach to answer almost all of the questions that we've raised tonight. And there's one piece of information. It's like a key, right? All you're missing, you locked out. All you need is the key. One key and you're in. There's one piece of information that's going to be the key point that will open up and unlock another way of looking at this entire scenario. And I mentioned it before. I actually dropped that breadcrumb before, that conceptual idea. And so when I say it now, it won't be unfamiliar. But maybe the application of that will be a little bit novel. I mentioned before that one of the mitzvot that are mentioned in this week's Torah portion is the mitzvah to support someone who is destitute. Basically, to give tzedakah. Take a look at text number 10. This is again from our Torah portion, this week's Torah portion, and it talks about the mitzvah of tzedakah. Sorry.
When you lend money to my people, to the poor person who's with you, you shall not behave toward him as a lender. You shall not impose interest upon him.
I always found the phraseology interesting. When you lend money, don't be a lender. Wait a second, I just lent the person money. I shouldn't be a lender. The Torah clarifies what it means. If you lend someone money, don't charge interest as lenders typically do. So this is specifically to Jew, lending to Jew. So it's family, it's mishpacha. We're one nation. So the Torah says, if you're lending to a brother or sister, you're not allowed to charge interest. Now, what's interesting is the Hebrew word that opens this verse is im, is the word im. Im kesev talva et ami, if you will lend money to a member of my people, says God. If. However, notice that the translation here is not if, but when. Why is that? The Mechilta explains text number 11. Jillian.
When you lend money to my people, Rabbi Ishmael said, every im, the first word in our verse in the Torah is understood to be the optional if, except for this one and two others, which are commands, i.e., it is compulsory to lend money to the poor, not optional. If you are faced with the poor of your family and the poor of your city, the poor of your family take precedence. If you are faced with the poor of your city and the poor of a different city, the poor of your city take precedence, since the verse says, the poor person with you.
So here we go. The Mechilta explains that im kesef talva, if you lend money, it's not if, it's when. It's not optional. If somebody's destitute, you have to support them. It's not optional. What do you mean? You have the choice not to? No, you don't. You have to support. And you have to support without interest. When I say support, you have to lend without interest. They have an obligation to pay back at some point, but you have an obligation to give. And if you're faced with a choice of who to give to, you always start with the closest first. First comes family, then comes community, and then you expand and broaden out. Why? Im kesev talva et ami et ha'ani imach. Give the poor that is with you, that is closest to you first, and then you fan out. So support your own first before you support others.
Well, this isn't like the people that knock on your door, because they're not asking for a loan. They're asking for just one. But they're not expected to pay back.
Correct.
So is this?
In this case, it's talking about specifically a loan.
A loan.
Yeah, it's a loan. So but when you're giving a loan, it has to be a no interest loan. So what this does is this opens up. This is the key point that opens up a new way of understanding. You see, in our second scenario, not the thief. Our second scenario, the fellow was so destitute that his only recourse was what? We said before, was to sell himself into slavery. Was that his only recourse? Was that his only recourse?
No.
Based on this text, what was his other recourse?
Take a loan.
So why didn't he take a loan?
His wife and children.
He has a wife and children that he can't support. Okay. But why doesn't he take a loan?
He may not have a way to pay it back.
Huh?
Pay it back.
He can't pay it back.
He can't pay it back. So let him take a loan and start up a business. Why doesn't he take a loan? Interest-free loan. Again, if he wants a loan, the Jewish community is obligated by biblical law to provide that money. Right? It's incumbent on whoever and everyone to give that loan. So again, we're dealing with the second scenario, right? Somebody so destitute, cannot support himself, his wife, and his kids, no clothes, no food. Okay, he needs money. Or he needs to take care of them somehow. Okay, I have an answer. The Torah says, someone's destitute, then everyone else has an obligation to lend him money. So why doesn't he take a loan?
He lacks initiative.
Perhaps. What else happens when you take a loan?
Become a slave anyway.
You become a slave on some level, but you have to pay it back. What happens? What option did he take? He didn't take a loan. What option did he exercise in our case?
Slave.
Well, how is that different than taking a loan?
The answer supports you.
Yeah. Yeah. In a sense, in a sense, not in every sense, but in a sense, which is easier? You see, he can't support his family. So what happens? He says, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of taking a loan and taking responsibility and having obligations and everything that comes with it, instead, I'll just be a slave. And then I won't have to all work. I'll get taken care of well, right? Same meal, same bed, right? Tempur-Pedic situation, right? Sleep number, whatever, right? Same deal, Stearns and Foster or whatever it is, right? The same coil count, and this dude is going to have to support me and my family, living the good life. You have to work a little bit, but it's okay. I don't have to worry about anything else. You see what happened? There was an option to get a loan and in a sense to stand on his own two feet and have an obligation now to support himself. But instead, he opted for the slavery route. Now, it's weird to say that the slavery route is the easier way out, but that's why I said in a sense, it is. It's at least taking the less responsible. It's not taking the full responsibility for his family on his own shoulders. He's now passed it to someone else. You with me on this? Okay. Let's keep on developing this idea. Actually, the next text we're going to read is text 13, where the Rebbe really hammers this idea home and explains and it really answers all of our questions. But first, let me share it outside and then we'll read it inside because it's such a beautiful text. I want to set it up right so it has the full impact. Basically, where we're going with this is to say the following. You know, when a person's in a desperate situation, we don't judge their actions. We said before, when it comes to a thief, straight up, if a thief is stealing because of desperation, we have compassion. They have to pay it back, but we understand that could happen and we have compassion for that. When a person's in a desperate situation, can't support and says, you know what, let me become a slave, we have compassion. But 6 years later, they're not in a desperate situation, right? They're taken care of. They have good food to eat. The slave has good food to eat, a good bed to sleep on, right? The amenities that come with living in that house. The family is being taken care of. It's 6 years later. The desperate times are not, it's not like living in desperation. And now the person is told, Mazel Tov, you can now resume your life. and take a loan if you need. But you cannot resume your life, and this person says, you know what? I'm good. I don't need that responsibility. I'm good. Let me just stay where I am. That's when the ear situation happens. As the Rebbe will explain in text 13, the ear is not for the choice now, but it's for what the choice now is revealing about them. It's revealing that when they opted it for it 6 years prior, they didn't opt because they were desperate for slavery, because they were desperate. They opted because they didn't want the responsibility. Take a look at text 13. David.
When first becoming a slave, we do not punish the man by piercing his ear, since he is compelled by difficult circumstances. However, if after 6 years of slavery he claims, I love my master, and does not seek his freedom, this proves that he does not view his slavery as a necessary evil. Rather, when he sold himself to begin with, it was not because he lacked any other choice, but simply because he doesn't mind being a slave. It may be true that his current wish to remain with the master is not necessarily punishable with ear piercing, inasmuch as he was compelled, at least to some extent, by his natural love of his wife and children.
That's the new wife and children.
However, when he now states, I love my master, we know that he truly does not mind being a slave. This proves that his initial act of selling himself into slavery was not out of duress, but rather his true wish. And so we punish him for the initial act of actively seeking out a master.
The Rebbe doesn't say we punish him. He just says we bore the hole in the ear for the initial act of actively seeking out a master. In other words, if we understand that the natural state of a human being is not to be a slave to another human being, but rather not to be indentured to another human being, but rather to be your own mensch who works for God, an independent person who has responsibilities, who works for God, and this person is saying, no, I don't want that. I wanna just be a slave to someone else and have them take care of me and my family and my kids and all that stuff. This is something where the Torah is not completely satisfied with, and hence the boring of the ear. Now, does this really explain why still the boring of the ear? You still have to fall back on some other commentaries, but it at least opens up a little bit of an insight into a deeper understanding of what is at the core of this fellow's choice now 6 years later. It's not simply a fact that he loves his family, his new family. He doesn't have any other options. He has options, but he's not standing up and being independent. He's not taking that responsibility. And so, in the final analysis, we understand the significance of this mitzvah and why it's at the beginning of Mishpatim, following the experience at Sinai and the Ten Commandments. Because the first message that we get in this week's Torah portion is that a human being has to stand on their own two feet and take responsibility and be, in other words, God wants us, God has enlisted us to make a difference. As long as we're in a state of being taken care of, we're not making a difference actively. We're still a slave to someone else, and they've got all the responsibilities, and we're just like a cog in someone else's mission in life. And God wants us each to have our own say, to have our own imprint. And that happens when we step out, we cut the cord, and we become on our own. And for everybody, for each one of us, I would say each one of us has areas in our lives where we are dependent and independent. You know, no person is ever truly independent, and no person is ever truly dependent. Everyone has dependencies and states of independence. And the message here is to try to encourage us, to try to, you know, ease us into seeking more independence rather than dependence, whether it's on another human being, or whether it's on any of the other crutches that human beings are dependent on. You know, some people are dependent on a cell phone, or on likes on Facebook, or whatever it is. The point is to be less dependent than other human beings, and to stand on our own two feet and accomplish on our own. In the context of the slave, it means you need to take risks. You need to take a loan and take risks and become responsible and step out and take care of your family. In the context of you and I, it might mean to do whatever, in whatever areas that we find ourselves a little bit dependent, to be more independent and to take action where necessary. There's actually one more text, text 14, which I'll summarize. It's in conjunction with the anniversary of the passing of Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka, the Rebbe's wife. She passed away in 1988. And what I want to share with you is an excerpt of a talk that the Rebbe gave in 1992. I'm sorry, she passed away in 1987. So this talk was given in 1992. That's wrong. It's not 5772. It is absolutely incorrect. 5772 was 7 years ago. There were no talks by the Rebbe 7 years ago. It should be 5752. And again, 1992. And the Rebbe gave this talk on her yard set, which is the 22nd of Shvat, which is a day before my bar mitzvah. This talk was given a day before my actual bar mitzvah date. My bar mitzvah was 1992. And the Rebbe said on the anniversary of her passing, basically, that, you know what, let's read it inside. Tim, final text, text 14.
A yahrzeit is a day commemorating the moment when the soul departed from the body. A sad moment for the body, a moment when it was deprived of the expression of a pure, holy Jewish soul. Certainly the intent of a sad moment, like any dip, is to spur greater growth, both with regards to the soul that has departed, as well as those left behind who are connected with that soul. The intent is that they should be blessed with added life, full of Torah in this world.
So here the Rebbe reframes a yahrzeit. It's a sad day, he says. Certainly it's a sad day, but the intent is to spur greater growth, not to be, in a sense, dependent, not to be held back by the sadness of the yahrzeit, or the sadness of the day, but rather to be inspired by the significance of the day to take a leap forward. And really today's class was all about taking a leap forward. What we want for the Jewish slave after 6 years of dependency is take a leap forward. Step out, be vulnerable, take a leap forward. When he chooses otherwise, collectively, we, all right, to the door with you, right? So. Why? Because all we want is for all of us and for ourselves primarily to take another step toward growth and independence and greater good. We see this reflected in many areas of Judaism. It's about being vulnerable and taking daring steps. So for each of us, let us find an area or two in our lives that we can take one more step forward and be a little less in our protection, in our protected spaces, and put ourselves out there to make a difference. After all, that is why we are here. Thank you very, we'll formally close out. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies. A very robust applause, thank you.